Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to bring you a program on landscaping with native plants. And Molly Fifield-Murray, one of our guests today, directs outreach and education programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum. And Molly, great to have you back.
Hey, Larry. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And Mark Wegner with us as well. Mark is the database manager at the Arboretum and architect of a new program that you can find online. It's called IMAP. And he's going to explain that to us and tell us about it. And certainly we'll answer your questions relating to the IMAP and also relating to landscaping with native plants. That's something I enjoy talking about, and I know you enjoy hearing about it. So give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Molly, what's it look like out there at the Arboretum these days?
Well, there's still some fall colors, still some maples with leaves on in spite of the big wind last year week. And, of course, the prairie grasses are still red, little blue stems red, and the Indian grass and big blue are sort of gold-colored. So it's not bleak yet.
No.
And nothing's blooming, but lots of winter birds coming through. The juncos are here, and the white-throated sparrows have come through.
I actually think it's a pretty time of the year.
Yes.
Out there in the Arboretum. Mark, what do you think?
I agree. It's gorgeous. There's actually, quite a few trees still with some nice color, including that tupelo tree right outside the visitor center.
So there's still plenty to see at the Arboretum, and I guess that goes with all the planning that's taken place over 75 years.
75 years ago, in August, the Civilian Conservation Corps came, and of course the Arboretum had started in 1934 officially. That was the dedication. And they started planting lilacs 75 years ago because that was the pioneer shrub that was relating to what the pioneers had when they came. So, and the other thing, this time of year, you can really see the effigy mounds well. And we have a very nice, stable collection of the effigy mounds in Galistel and Wingra Woods.
Yeah, and really cool. And this is a good time. This is a great time of the year to
see
that.
Well, you can see them, and there aren't any mosquitoes, so it's a great...
Well, Mark, you've been working on something called IMAP relating to the Arboretum, and tell us what's behind that.
Sure. This is a way that we kind of wanted to give people a little bit more information about the Arboretum and not just general visitor information, although that's always nice to get, such as, when are we open, where can you park, what can you see. We also wanted to give people a little bit more information about some of the research that's going on at the Arboretum and also about some of the issues that we face in performing our restoration, such as invasive species and stormwater. And so we came up with a geographic platform to do all of that. And again, like you mentioned, it's called IMAP. It is at uwarboretum.org/map. If you go right to the Arboretum main website, there's a link to it there. And you can view a little tutorial if you're not familiar with how to run an interactive map, a little tutorial video. Otherwise, you can be taken right to the map. And again, it's a way for people to explore on their own, but to get a lot more information about what it is that we do and what we have to offer at the Arboretum.
Yeah, so visually, so we see a map, and then there are some little boxes that may pop up here and there.
Right, so the map is organized into three main tabs that go across the top of the map. There's a Go tab, a Learn tab, and a Your Turn tab. The Go tab, that's where we tried to put a lot of just general visitor information, so... what do people want to know? They want to know, what's there, what can I see, where are the trails, where are the trailheads, restrooms, that kind of thing. We also have that organized by activity type. So if you're a runner or a biker or a skiing enthusiast, you can view data that only relates to that particular activity. The Learn tab is where we put, like I mentioned, a lot of this, a little bit more in-depth information about the Arboretum. So ecological data, monitoring data, wildlife data, that stuff is all under the Learn tab. And then this Your Turn tab, the idea here is that we wanted people to be able to contribute their own information to the map. So people can upload their own photos and geotag them, and they'll appear on the map for other people to view. They can also do that with experiences. So they can kind of choose a little portion of the arboretum where maybe they saw some interesting things or, you know, maybe a lot of birds or had an interesting time. And they can share that on the map for other people as well. So that's the tab where we're hoping to kind of create a little bit of an online community focused on the arboretum.
That sounds really cool. And well, you're a database manager, but you obviously also have a strong interest and some background in this area as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel really lucky to be at the Arboretum. I do have kind of a technical background, but I've also got kind of a general environmental education background. And I feel really lucky to be at the Arboretum and to get to kind of soak off the knowledge of people like Molly. And our director is fantastic and lets me get involved with a lot of things that kind of go beyond my education. So that's my favorite part of my job.
Well, it's pretty cool. And again, I would invite you, if you're near your computer, go to uwarboretum.org. It's uwarboretum.org/map. And you can look it up. Maybe you'll have a question about it as we move along here. And speaking of moving along, Pete, in Wadsworth, Illinois, up first. Pete, hello. Thank you for calling.
How are you doing this morning?
Good. What's on your mind?
Well, there's so many benefits from having prairie plants in your landscape. I mean, they're just so many. There's thousands, actually. I have thousands of plants here I'm looking at right now. But the real beauty for me is after everything's flowered and things are dormant, up until like January or even February, my prairie, it smells very sweet. So as you come to my front door, there's this constant fragrance that is all around you as you approach our home. And it's really a joy to have that after the prairie's gone dormant.
That's right. Do you have a particular plant right there that you like the best? Or?
Well, we have so many different ones. You know, we have all kinds of echinacea and, you know, the milkweeds and the asters. But, I can't believe the size of our praying mantis we have around our home. They are huge and numerous. We found a praying mantis sacks on our property. And it's, they're gargantuan.
One of the great advantages of that kind of a prairie, isn't it?
Well, we had a native landscaping conference this fall, and Doug Tallamy was our guest speaker. He's written a wonderful book called Bringing Nature Home, and one of the advantages of native plants is they attract the native animals, including all the insects and butterflies, and provide food for them and habitat. So, yeah, it's not just one thing that's happening. You're actually living with the ecosystem.
Yeah. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. Jennifer in Spooner, let's go to you next. Hi, Jen.
Hi. I have a shady slope in the back of the yard that's about a 6-foot slope, and wondering what kind of plants I can put there that won't need to be trimmed or mowed.
So what are the trees providing the shade?
Oak.
Yep. So is it sandy soil or a good forest soil, or which?
Sandy soil.
Okay. Well, oak savanna species be in a wide range of shade and sun conditions. A really nice one on a steep slope is Pennsylvania sedge, which will form sort of a mat and help out holding the slope. Then you have things that are like wild strawberries that vine, or old field cinquefoil, a potentilla, and they would vine and form some mats to help. But planting a group of oak savanna species would really do well in a situation like that. Even something you might think of more as a woodland plant, like wild geranium, would spread in there.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much, Jen, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email at talk@wpr.org as we talk landscaping with native plants and also taking a look at the Arboretum's new interactive map. Molly Fifield-Murray and Mark Wagner, our guests. And let's turn to Ray in Coloma next. Ray, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. My question concerns the usefulness of fire in managing for prairie vegetation. As a former Madison resident, I'm very interested in the arboretum, and having had plant ecology courses from Curtis and Cottom, partly out on the arboretum, I'm even more interested in it. Now, I recently heard a rumor that using fire in the on the arboretum prairie to keep woody vegetation out or down has not been entirely successful, and I wondered about that, and if you could bring me up to date, is that true, and do you have any reasons for it?
Well, of course, the use of fire in prairies was originated at the Arboretum by Curtis and others who were studying how you restore a prairie. Excuse me, and they looked at burning off old pasture grasses and encouraging the prairie plants. And of course, prairie plants are adapted to fire, but there are also woody plants that are adapted to fire, such as gray dogwood and sumac, and even aspens. So when you have a prairie that's confined, like Curtis Prairie is, in an area surrounded by woody plants, then it's a little bit harder to maintain it with only fire. And in fact, this is something that they didn't really know when they started all the restorations at the Arboretum, and they planted aspens on the edge of the Arboretum on purpose, which no one would do today. Because it's a fire-adapted species, and its role in life is to invade the grassland. So I also think it's a question of when you burn, and frequently we are not able to burn when others can, because we've been surrounded by the city now, and we have to manage our smoke. And we also have to be very, very careful about the fires getting away because of all the housing around us. So we cannot burn on the days when it might most damage woody plants. Whereas someone out, out on Military Ridge might be able to burn on a dry, windy day, we cannot. So we cannot always damage the woody plants as much as we might need to. So fire is not the only tool that we can use. We do have to go in and do some cutting. And multiple cuttings can do it, but if you don't have the labor for that, cuttings and using herbicides on the stumps is something we're working with.
All right. Roy,
thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate your call. Thank you very much for calling. Talking landscaping with native plants today with our guests, Molly Fifield-Murray and Mark Wagner. Mark is the database manager for the Arboretum's new IMAP program. And, of course, Molly directs outreach and education programs for the UW Arboretum in Madison. Join us at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions as we talk native landscaping with native plants. Or email us, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio is having an open house this Sunday at our studios here in Madison, and you are invited to come visit. Should be fun. It's a free event, and we're kind of celebrating our 20th anniversary of the Ideas Network. And so November 7th, that's Sunday, from 1 to 4 p.m., and I will be here, and along with a lot of other program hosts. I know Gene Farrakka will be here, Ben Marins, Michael Feldman will be along, Joy Cardine will be here, and many, many more. And we have some tours of our studios, and we'll let you record your own story about your favorite public radio network, and we're going to have some great food. We're going to have some live music. We're going to have some. Little presentations. I'll be giving one that sort of relates to history. I think Michael Feldman will be here to give one to talk about. Who knows what? You know, you never know with Michael. And there are some others as well. So it's going to be lots of fun. And it's this Sunday from 1 to 4 p.m. in Vilas Communications Hall, the 7th floor of Vilas Hall on the UW Madison campus. And I know that the Packers play in the evening, not during the afternoon. So if you're worried about that, don't have to worry about it. Okay, let's turn our attention to landscaping with native plants and the Arboretum's interactive map as we talk with our two guests, Molly Fifield-Murray and also with Mark Wagner. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. You know, with the Molly, with the emerald ash borer, you know, here we've got it now in parts of Wisconsin, Milwaukee area for sure, and maybe Green Bay is another area too where we have it, and I think don't we have it over on the west side of the state?
Yeah, somewhere near La Crosse, I believe.
Near Hudson. Yeah. What are some landscape trees that you might consider to replace your ash tree?
Well, it's going to be a difficult thing to do in some ways because ashes have been planted many different ways. Some of them are along streets, and some of them are in the backyard as a shade tree. Many of them are the exact same plant because they are autumn purple white ash.
Yeah.
The first, which was selected here on campus, actually, the original tree is by Ag Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first cultivars are at the Arboretum, and we're watching them very carefully. And the color on them is spectacular. So it's going to be difficult to replace them with the color and the shape and the functions. But there are other native trees that can be used. There's Celtus, common hackberry, is very tolerant of city situations and can be used. It has a yellow fall color, very interesting bark, pebbly bark. It can spread by roots a little bit, not like an aspen, but it'll send up another one. Perhaps red maples in certain situations. Dr. Hazelkus would recommend Acer freemanii, which is a hybrid of the red maples, and he thinks that's a good use. And there's even American elms that are now available that have been shown to be resistant to the Dutch elm disease. So the one that Dr. Hazelkus would recommend is the Ulmus americana Princeton.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I haven't seen it as a mature tree, so I don't know if it has that wonderful form that elms used to have arching over a landscape, but it's still a suitable tree. You know, the trees that do the best along the streets are the trees that grow naturally in floodplain forests,
yeah,
which is why the American elm was so good, why the locust works well. The things that don't work well along streets are the trees that need a forest, like sugar maple wants shading on its trunk. It wants good soil. It doesn't want drought and salt,
right,
and trampling. So, but if you have if your ash is in your yard, you have a wider choice of trees. You can go with any of the maples. If there's some protection around there, you can go with river birch, which is faster, mm-hmm, growing, but won't be necessarily a single stem large tree. So there are a lot of choices. And the oaks, of course, are wonderful wildlife trees. People don't plant them because they think they're slow. But if you come to see our gardens behind the Arboretum, you can see that even if you plant them fairly small trees, they are interesting in the landscape fairly quickly.
We have some callers online. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, but some emailers as well at talk@wpr.org. So let's turn to Barb in River Falls, who emailed wondering if you could discuss milkweed. We were surprised by its most wonderful fragrance. This is the bonus to the attraction of monarch butterflies. What else can you tell us about milkweed?
Well, there are many species of milkweed. The one that is the most fragrant is the common one, which some people think of as weedy. But if it's near your house and in a prairie garden, it's quite wonderful, as are the marsh milkweeds. There's a milkweed called whorled milkweed that does well in very dry places. All of them attract the monarchs. I've seen monarch larvae in the whorled milkweed, which is a tiny little plant, but they're chomping down. Milkweed is almost an ecosystem in itself. It attracts many kinds of insects that are very interesting. They're milkweed bugs. They are bright orange with black on them, and they are quite common in the fall. You might confuse them with box elder bugs, but they mm-hmm. aren't. And the interesting thing about them is they're a tiny little insect, and they migrate to the coast in the fall.
Oh,
they don't come back as the same individual doesn't come back, so it's not called a true migration. But they go south, they have another generation, and that generation comes north in the spring. So the milkweed is a fascinating plant, and the fragrance is a bonus.
Absolutely. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, let's turn to you next. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Larry and guests. I know the election was Tuesday, but I'd like to do a little electioneering for Nyssa. Your young man mentioned the tupelo tree there at the Arboretum. I commercially grow that tree after Dr. Hazelkist impressed on me how beautiful that tree was, and I've since realized and been told by other professors in that a woody plant, especially woody trees, the finest fall color of any tree is a tupelo, a Nyssa. And I think I agree with that 100%. And I think what needs to be expressed to people is that tupelo that's at the Arboretum has survived 28 below zero, which is probably the hardiest tupelo you can get your hands on. And that's tupelo is in Elvis Presley's hometown. So they don't usually think about 28 below down there.
Well, and that's a good caution, because if you are buying a tupelo, they are native in the very southeast corner of Wisconsin. There's a stand of them. If you buy a tupelo, don't buy one from the south, because it's not, even though they grow in a wide range, you don't want to get one from the south, just like you wouldn't buy a sugar maple from Tennessee to plant here. You would buy a sugar maple from Wisconsin or Minnesota to plant here. So, yes, it's a beautiful tree. You know, we were talking about it, whether it could be a replacement for an ash, but it has a much different form. How would you describe the form, Mark, as a sort of pyramid?
Well, yeah, it is more.
You'd have to trim it up to have it on a street, but it'd be beautiful in your yard. So
yeah, it would be gorgeous. Phil, go ahead.
I think people who will tell you that tree's a little slow growing need to remember once in a while, you don't always plant a tree for yourself. You plant a tree for once you're gone.
Yeah, that's another good point. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Nancy in Racine up next, and then we'll go to Jean in Menominee. Nancy, hi.
Hi there.
What's on your mind?
Well, I've just reading an article in the recent edition of the Wild Ones Journal that is talking about the huge increase in allergies that is resulting from engineered horticulture that is pushing us in to plant trees, particularly that are not messy in the landscape. So this this urge to have easily cared for, neat landscape results in all of these. It says they're using male-cloned trees and shrubs in our landscapes, and that translates into an excess of allergenic pollen. So I'm wondering if the person that you have chatting with you today has any comment on this.
All right. Thank you for calling, Nancy. And Molly, any comments on that?
Well, I haven't read the article, but that is true, that in many situations in cities that they plant male trees, they're not always engineered trees, because some trees are dioecious and some are monoecious, and so some trees have male and female plants, and they tend to plant male trees because they're not dropping seeds. Well, but they are spreading pollen. And so in particular with the trees that are planted along streets that are frequently male trees, they have greatly increased the amount of pollen. There are certain trees that you would never want to, well, hardly ever, want to plant the female and to get out of native plants a little bit. The female ginkgo, while a beautiful tree, has horrible smelling fruit. All you have to do is Google smelly tree and you'll get ginkgo. And so the thing is that nurseries don't always know if it's a tree grown from seed. They won't know if it's male or female until it's old enough to produce flowers. So that's one reason why female ginkgos do show up sometimes. But yes, it is true that pollen has increased greatly.
There you go. Thank you for calling, Nancy. Jean in Menominee, we'll turn to you. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I have a question about the ash borer. I have a mountain ash. Do they tend to bug those?
Was that a pun? I'm sorry, I couldn't pass that up. No, it's a different genus of plant, and even though it's called mountain ash, it's not Fraxinus, which is the ash genus. So it's a different one. Yes, yeah. But European mountain ashes and American mountain ashes have plenty of other diseases to be concerned about. So.
Well, so far that was one tree that didn't have a problem this year.
Okay,
but I do have a question about planting one of those hybrid. Elm trees I still have on the property, elm trees that are still dying.
Well,
Should I wait till they're all gone?
Well, you could also, if you have a really special elm, there are commercial products that tree arborists can use to protect an individual tree if you choose to spend the money to keep the insect out that carries the disease.
Yeah, they're way too far gone.
Okay.
They've got big blisters on the branches. And
well,
you might want to have an arborist take a look.
Why don't you look up Princeton and see if it says it's resistant or, they might be resistant but not totally immune. So
yeah. I live surrounded by a waterfall area, so I get a lot of allergens. And my yard is sandy loam. So I end up digging my holes three times deeper and getting lots of dirt and stuff in there. What would be the best trees for a sandy loam?
One of the things you may not want to do is fill that hole with really rich dirt or dirt that's there. Isn't that right, Molly?
That's right. If you have sandy loam, I actually love sandy loam soil because it's easy to dig, and if you plant the right species there, it's not going to be a problem. You do not want to alter the soil in the hole because then the shrub or tree roots never leave the hole. They'll stay in the nice peat moss. But if you keep the soil the same and mulch it on top to keep water in the hole, that helps a lot. There are a great number of trees. It depends on what you're looking for in a tree. The service berries do well on sandy loam. Amelanchier laevis is one of my favorite trees. It's a wonderful wildlife tree. It's not a shade tree. It's a small tree.
Yeah, I'm looking for something for the birds. I lost two bushes this summer, and my bush cherry hasn't done anything in 4 years.
Wow. Well, why don't you look at the amelanchiers, because the birds are all over it in June. It's one of the first things to produce fruit, and so it's very attractive. I think every species of bird that's around in June goes to the amelanchiers.
Yeah, we've got a pile of birds.
Okay,
good.
Persnickety.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Darwin and DeSoto, we'll go to you. Hi, Darwin.
Good morning. How you be today?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been listening to today's conversation, and I thought I might slip in a little subject here that a lot of people don't think about. Most everybody's got to use chemicals and mow their lawns and do this and do that and make everything look so pretty in town, and yet I've been living in the woods for the last 14, 15 years, born and raised in them, and all that, the cherries and the weeds, as people call them, this is all protective cover for the moles and the voles and so on and so forth. So they eat the low shrubbery and so-called weeds first, protecting the oak trees, which are surface roots, from those animals getting those oak roots. And I've got oak trees sitting here 3 feet around, 90 feet tall, healthy as all get out. And if you try to manicure the lawn on those things, you will kill them.
Well, what do you think, Molly?
Well, I agree that it's best to try to not do a lot of maintenance under most native trees, particularly the oaks. Oaks cannot tolerate trampling in particular. They're very sensitive to, don't park your car in the shade of an oak or protect them during construction. That's very important. And oaks are the best wildlife tree. Cherries are second. So a lot of people don't like cherries because they're those messy trees, but they're fine in the woods. I have seen voles, girdle hickories, which is amazing feat. But I agree that trying to have some natural plantings under the trees and letting them grow is fine. The only reason we use herbicides at the arboretum is to keep the trees out of the prairie or to get rid of the invasive species such as buckthorn and honeysuckle.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Mark, I want to turn back to you for a minute here to get the discussion to some extent to the IMAP. This is a customized picture, right, of the University Arboretum.
That's correct.
And where did you get your data for that? Or how did you get your data?
Yeah, good question. So the data came from a variety of sources. One of the main sources is our own archives. So if you can picture it, we have a room sitting there with all these paper maps in it. And, you know, they may or may not be viewed by even staff that may or may not even know that they're there. What we've done is scan a lot of these maps. You know, in particular, there is a soil map. It turns out that our best soil information for the arboretum came from a 1938 paper report. Someone had come out, a graduate student, and done a soil survey. And it was a very small paper map tucked into a report sitting in the archives. What we've been able to do with the IMAP and where some of this data came from is either through scanning or through data conversion, converting that data into a digital format and then into a format that can appear and be consumed by people on our map. So you can actually, in fact, go view that soil map, that 1938 soil map, you know, as it appeared in that report on our map. So that's one source. Some of the data is just public data. So there's, you know, aerial photos, the kind of thing that you'd see on like Google Maps. We have aerial photos loaded in there that you can zoom in on. We actually have aerial photos dating back to 1937 that you can interact with. So again, some of it's public data. There's some monitoring data on there that we've gathered throughout the years at the Arboretum on things like species richness. And then some of it is research data. So we had, for example, a graduate student who did we were just talking about buckthorn and invasives. We had a graduate student a year or two ago that did a full inventory, wall-to-wall inventory of buckthorn in the arboretum and characterized its abundance at something like 1,000 different locations. Yeah, he was a hard worker. So we were able to take that data, put it again into this spatial format, and put it into a graphic design that makes it so that people can get that information.
What's your favorite part of the map?
Well, I guess a couple things. One thing I think that's really cool is I get this question all the time because I've been kind of in charge of the data. Is people want to come out and take a hike or take a run or whatever in the arboretum, or maybe they have their favorite hiking route. And they want to know how far that is. This is something that I get asked all the time. Now there is an actual tool on the interactive map called a measure tool, where you can actually click on this tool and then click around, you know, follow the path that you like to follow. And it'll give you kind of a running total of exactly how far that is in either miles or kilometers. So it's my favorite because I think it's cool, but it's also my favorite because it'll save me a lot of time answering that question from people.
Oh, that's great. And I want to remind you that if you'd like to see that map and a map of the Arboretum, just go to, let's see, it's arboretum.org, right? uwarboretum.org/map.
That's right. There's also a link to it directly from uwarboretum.org. If you don't want to type all that in, you'll see a link that'll pop up pretty prominently when you go to our main homepage.
Take a look at it as you listen to the calls and questions here as we go move along. Lynn in Richfield, let's go to you. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I have two questions about pines. The first one is I've got a bunch of white pines mixed with a couple of different types of evergreens, and I'm wondering, since the ground hasn't froze yet, should I be watering them since we had such a dry summer? Should I water them before the ground freezes?
That's an excellent idea. I don't know exactly where Richfield is, but in our part... I'm southeast.
Yeah.
Our part of the state was incredibly dry, and we have on our property 300-year-old oaks. This is my home property, not the arboretum. And they were very stressed, and we've been losing some of them. And the arborist said, well, it's partly drought. So we took the couple that were closest to the house and started watering them in August because it's been so dry. And watering conifers before the winter is very, very important. So if you have special conifers that are accessible with a hose, I would water them in. It doesn't look like the weather's going to change very much any near time, and you do want to get the water in the ground. One of the hardest things for conifers is to go through a dry winter, and particularly if we don't get snow. Or if we get snow, but it doesn't melt, and then the ground is dry, it's very hard on the conifers.
Yeah, Bruce Allison has said, water right up until freeze up. And I know the hose gets stiff, and it's hard to pull around and everything, but we keep our hoses out right to freeze up
right.
Water, and I think that makes a difference.
Okay, and my second question is regarding Austrian pine? I understand that pines tend to lose like a third of their needles a year.
Yes.
Or so. I've got one in between two others, and it seems to have lost a third, almost maybe two-thirds of its needles. They went brown this summer, but from the bottom up instead of evenly dispersed. Is this tree probably dying?
Well, that's a question I can't answer. I don't know very much about the Austrian pines, but you could go to an extension agent. First of all, look for any obvious signs of disease or insect infestation. And then if you can, take off a small branch and take it to your local extension office and see if they can help you. If they can't, you can always send it to the plant diagnostic lab in Madison, and they can help you. It could be drought, and because it's in the middle, the other two trees are taking all the water. I mean, there's any number of things.
Yeah, could be anything. If you take a sample, it's best to try and get a sample of maybe a branch that's partially or half dead rather than one that's completely dead.
And, yeah, if it's dried up, it's not going to show them anything necessarily.
Yeah. Yep, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. As long as we're on evergreens, Sandra in Madison wondered if there are native evergreens that would thrive in the Madison area. Are there any that might work in a hedge setting?
Well, there are a number of native evergreens in the Madison area, but they all depend on the conditions. The most common one is the common juniper, Juniperus virginiana. It's not as green as or blue as as some of the spruces or others, but it is the native evergreen for drier sites. Of course, white cedar, arborvitae, are native in the Madison or southern Wisconsin, and but they need a little bit more moisture. They are greener, of course. You can get cultivars of these that sometimes might have conditions that you are more interested in as far as color. But yes, those two are the most common ones. And then in western Dane County, red pines and white pines are native. They are in the Driftless area, mm-hmm. and were there since the glacier or soon after the glacier. And so it depends on where you are in the state, what's exactly native. But you need to look at the soils and the moisture conditions to put the right one there.
Thanks again for those questions. We are visiting today with Molly Fifield-Murray, who directs outreach and education programs for the UW-Madison Arboretum, and Mark Wagner, database manager at the Arboretum and architect of the new IMAP that they have online that you got to take a look at. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on this edition of Garden Talk as we talk landscaping with native plants and the UW-Madison Arboretum and its new interactive map. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Mark Wagner and Molly Fifield-Murray. And we had a question about, I can't see who it's from. But anyway, they've purchased mature prairie grasses, prairie drop seed, and Indian grass, and would like to incorporate these in a shoreline project on the bank above the lakeshore, 15 feet in sandy soil with full to mostly full sun in western Waukesha County. Historically, what were the linkages, relationships between shorelines and prairies?
Well, I think if you're on a lake in Waukesha County, the prairie would have come right up to the shoreline, and drop seed and Indian grass, little bluestem, all of those are excellent species. There are also some more unusual grasses and sedges. You can look on any of the nursery sites and see some of those that would be acceptable. If it's sandy soil, even the Pennsylvania sedge that I mentioned earlier, a lot of the nurseries have many more sedges available than they used to. And some of the more unusual grasses, the Muhlenbergias and some of the others, are available. If you're over in the lake, the Great Lakes, the shoreline is a little bit different and has different species that would be particular to there. If you're interested in original sources for some of these things, you can look at John Curtis's Vegetation of Wisconsin, and he has a community of the lakeshore, the Great Lake Lakeshore, mm-hmm. That would tell you what was growing there originally.
Alex in Eau Claire, let's go to you now. Hi, Alex. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I just had a comment to make. Heard you were talking about trees and working here. This tree in Eau Claire, it's got to be the biggest tree in Eau Claire. It's in the University Nature Arboretum, Putnam Park.
Okay.
This tree, I mean, literally you have to have like five people holding hands to surround this thing.
Oh.
It's the biggest tree I've seen outside of Alaska living.
It's, do you know what it is? Elk or elm or oak?
I have no idea, actually.
Oak, probably.
Putnam Park, the big one. No, there's another tree that's right next to it, though. It had this really awesome tree fort in it. It used to have a dual layer, like a two-story tree house. And my friend and I, we used to hang out in there all the time until, I don't know who did it, but somebody cut their way into the woods there and cut down the first level. I was pretty bummed about that.
Well, this large tree, just what do the leaves look like? Do you know what the leaves look like on it?
My friend tells me it was an elm tree.
Okay.
But, I mean, the thing, it's huge, and it's kind of sad.
Hmm. Yeah, it is. Well, it's lived a long life. As you know, thinking about the arboretum here in Madison, Mark, we've got some pretty good-sized trees as well.
That's right. One of the things that we're actually doing right now is trying to get a kind of comprehensive tree inventory for the arboretum. We're doing it in two different ways. We have a horticultural collection called Longenecker Gardens that people in Madison are probably very familiar with. And so we've got a volunteer that's going around and getting GPS locations for all of those different trees. And with those GPS locations, then we can do things like not only put them on this map, for people to view, but also link them directly to the information about those trees that is maintained by our curator of the Longenecker Horticultural Gardens. We're also, for the rest of the property, because the horticultural collection is just a small part of the arboretum, we are looking into a way with some university professors and students to do a comprehensive tree inventory that would give us things not just like, species for every tree, but also some canopy information and size information. Mm. It's a really interesting project. It would be done using satellite imagery, multispectral satellite imagery, and very detailed elevation data. And essentially, a computer program would run through all this satellite imagery and all this elevation data and generate points for every tree in the arboretum, and give that automatically associate species and some different kind of attributes to each one of those trees. So
amazing, isn't it? What technology has done for us?
It really is. It's a fun time to be working on this stuff.
Absolutely. Kathy in Madison, let's turn to you. Hi, Kathy.
Well, hi. I have about a 6-year-old wild plum tree that I bought at an arboretum sale 6 years ago.
Okay.
And I have transplanted it a couple years ago when I found out after I took the Master Gardener's class how to plant trees, which was very helpful. But I wish to know how it never produces fruit. And I need to know how far I can go afield to buy some kind of plum tree that will interbreed with the wild plum that I bought at the arboretum.
Okay.
Well, I don't think you'll find a a different species of plum that would breed with the wild plum, but the wild plum will spread with by roots, and when it's old enough, it will produce fruit. I always recommend that people plant three of anything they're planting if they can. That way, if one dies, you still have two, and mm-hmm. if you have two, you can get pollination. So there's a whole number of things that need to happen. The plant needs to be mature enough to produce flowers and fruit.
Right.
And then you have to have the pollinators available.
Right.
And that's a whole other thing that we're doing at the Arboretum, is working with the Xerxes Society and other people on campus to figure out ways to encourage the wild bumblebees in particular and other native pollinators. So I don't know specifically why your tree hasn't produced fruit yet, but I've never heard of plums being hard to, they regenerate. Of course, you replanted it, so.
I wouldn't think so. No. I mean, I bought it from an Arboretum sale.
Right.
And for the express purpose of more for free bird feed than, you know.
Yeah, anything
sure.
else.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it will produce plums eventually, but and it will spread eventually by roots. But you replanted it 2 years ago, and so it has to reestablish itself before it can send out a runner to establish another plum.
Yeah, so you need to, and it also might have affected the fruit coming too.
Yes,
replanting it 2 years ago. So you've got a little waiting yet to do, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Paul in Cascade, let's turn to you. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I have a question. Oh, no, I don't have a question. I have a comment about a lady who called earlier about hybrid elms.
Yeah.
And whether or not they would grow alongside of or with established elms that have Dutch elm disease.
Correct.
I have that situation in my yard. I have three hybrid elms that are 13, 14, and 15 years old, planted one each year. And a lot of the elm trees in my yard have all succumbed to Dutch elm disease. They're cut down and removed. But my neighbor has a 10-acre parcel around me, and that's where all the elms are now that have Dutch elm disease and are dying. But mine are growing well in my yard for, like I say, 13, 14, and 15 years.
So they are resistant to the disease?
Yes.
So far. And do you know which hybrid you planted?
They're American Liberty Elms.
Okay.
From Harrisville, New Hampshire.
Okay. Yeah. We do have some Liberty Elms in the Arboretum if anybody wants to see them. They're in the horticultural garden. So you can see some of the hybrids, but like I said, they're not huge trees yet, and none of them have the elm shape that I've seen. Although I'm not familiar with the Princeton that Dr. Hazekas recommended.
Yeah, there you go. So there's some hope out there. And I should go back to that earlier caller, the gal who said her trees were succumbing. I think it's a good idea to get rid of those trees.
Right.
Cut those trees down and get the wood out of there, or at least get it covered.
Yeah, or get the bark off. Any number of ways to get rid of the beetles in particular that carry the disease.
That's what you really, really, really need to do if you're going to try and keep it from spreading. I'm sorry, what'd you say, Paul?
Is there still a problem with the elm beetles when the bark is off of the tree is dried up and fallen off?
No, my understanding is the recommendation for the elms, and it will be for the ashes also, and for oaks with oak wilt, which is also spread by insects, is to debark them. And as Larry said, cover them for a year, and then the wood might be, I still wouldn't transport the wood just in case, but no. You could use it for firewood.
You mm-hmm. could use it for firewood.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks very much for calling, although you should keep it covered.
Correct.
Outside.
A big tarp and yep. Cover it up completely.
Molly, what have you, Bonnie in Hobart, Wisconsin, says, what have you found to be the two or three most important things to convince people that planting native plants, be it trees, shrubs, or forbs, is crucial for our environment and biodiversity?
Well, I think anytime somebody asks me about, in particular, they want to plant a shrub for birds or they're interested in one part of the environment but not necessarily all of it, if somebody wants to plant a shrub for birds, I say, do you want native birds? And if you want native birds, you need to plant native plants. If you're interested in butterflies, you need to not only plant things that they can get nectar on, such as the fall-blooming asters, but you need to have the plants that the larvae eat. So you need to think in a holistic way. And native plants, a lot of people are planting things like tree lilacs along streets now and in their yards, and lots of people are planting something called the Norway maple. It's been planted for probably 50 years now. If you look at those plants, people like them because their leaves stay whole, but they provide no wildlife food.
No wildlife food. Molly Fifield-Murray and Mark Wegner of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum, our guests here on Garden Talk as we talk landscaping with native plants and the Arboretum's interactive map. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guests from the UW-Madison Arboretum, Molly Fifield-Murray, who directs outreach and education for the Arboretum, and Mark Wegner, database manager at the Arboretum and architect of the new IMAP that you will find if you go online to uwarboretum.org. That's probably the easiest way to do it. Just go there and you'll find a place to go right on the homepage to direct you to that map. It's really quite something. We have it up on one of our computers here, and I'm looking at, what am I looking at here? I've got an aerial view. Aren't we looking at here, Mark?
Yeah, we're looking at a historical photo. So this is a photo from 1937, which was the first comprehensive statewide aerial survey of Wisconsin, I think done by USDA, if I'm not mistaken. But so it's basically a bunch of photographs from 1937 patched together to form a seamless image. And on that image of this old aerial photo, you can see a lot of things, obviously, in the arboretum that aren't there anymore.
as
the old CCC camp is clearly visible, from which the first plantings were done. And also the area known as the Lost City in the arboretum. Yeah. A lot of the roads that were put in for that failed subdivision are clearly visible on this 1937 aerial photo.
You mentioned the CCC camp, and actually, Molly, there's a little tour going on this weekend, isn't there?
That's right. 1 o'clock on Sunday. Some of the information going out has been confused about it, I think because daylight savings time is a week later this year. But it's at 1 o'clock till 2:30, and then they could come over to your open house. So
that's right. That's not a bad idea.
There you go.
Come to this, and that's going to be a tour over there of the CCC camp.
Well, the CCC camp that's left, actually, we have one of the largest collections of original CCC buildings in the country, and we still use most of them. And then we'll walk out to see what the CCC did.
Oh, that's perfect. And then come on over to Vilas Hall. We're here from 1 to 4. I'll be here, and so a lot of other people as well, for our open house, free, open to the public, food, live entertainment, and a chance to meet me and probably better, Gene Faraca and Ben Marins and Michael Feldman. That's from 1 to 4, and I hope you can make it over. Maybe make it to both. Why not? Let's go to Rhoda in Rothschild as a question for us. Hi, Rhoda.
Hi there, Larry and Molly and Mark. I'm embarrassed to say I graduated from UW quite a few years ago. I have never been to the Arboretum. I'm going to have to take a trip down and do it.
You do. You need to do that.
Yes. Anyway, I'm living in a house that's about 50 years old, and so the trees around me are about that age, too. I've got maples and a couple different kinds of maples and balsams and white cedars, and they're huge, and the next-door neighbor has a humongous cottonwood tree. And so I've got a nice shade corner going, and I'm knowing these trees are not long for this world, and I'd like to start some new ones. And now my soil is sandy. I think I must be on the old Wisconsin River throughway here, and it's rather acid. I think my soil test said it was like pH between 5.2. So I need something that will survive in that kind of soil and something that's native, and that something that can survive in the shade of some other trees. Now, I know oaks are known to grow in the shade of their parents, but I'm not sure I want any more humongous trees.
Okay.
Well, trees are rated on their shade tolerance from 0 to 10, and 10 is something like hemlock and sugar maple. And the oaks vary from the bur oak being maybe a 2 or 3 to the red oaks being an 8 or 9. So you could, if you don't want large trees, then you're probably looking at something that grows in the mid-level understory of a maple forest. And if you've been to the Baraboo Hills, you would have seen these, something like Carpinus or musselwood. And the genus name is Carpinus, C-A-R-P-I-N-U-S, and the common name is musselwood. It's a beautiful, small, relatively slow-growing understory tree. The other one that you would see growing in a similar situation is ironwood.
Ah, I've heard of that.
Its genus is Ostrya, O-S-T-R-Y-A, and those are both excellent sort of small trees. Another thing that would grow in that situation that you described would be witch hazel, which is not really a tree, more of a shrub.
I've had that in Illinois.
Okay. And that's quite shade tolerant also.
Okay.
There are a few...
When these old trees die, will they still survive in full sun?
Well, if you're planting them, I would plant them in groups, perhaps, so that, I mean, if you have a 50-year-old maple, it's not necessarily going to die unless it's a silver maple.
Well, one of them is, and the arborist has put in a cobra, and we've trimmed it, and we're hoping.
Right. Well, silver maples are not long-lived, right. And they also aren't recommended near houses or streets anymore.
I know it is right next to my house. And the cottonwood is within reach of my maple, and it did blew a branch that hit my tree, my house.
Yes. Oh, well, they're both soft trees, and a good windstorm or an ice storm will take them down, or at least break them off at the top. We had a horrible ice storm here in the 70s, took off the tops of all the silver maples near where I lived, and they've regrown, but I wouldn't want to live under them anymore. So.
There you go. Thanks, Rhoda, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Dick and Dousman a chance next. Hi, Dick.
Good afternoon, folks. I always enjoy your show. The reason I'm calling, we have three or four acres of prairie that we put in about 8, 9, 10 years ago, and it was beautiful this last summer. And we are now for the first time starting to see some Baptista coming up, but they didn't blossom. And this next year we're going to burn the area where some of those are. Now, will that hurt or destroy those Baptista, or should I try to protect them from the burn?
Well, all the prairie plants are adapted in some way to the fire, and Baptisia is very well adapted to fire, and it will increase flowering after a burn. If you're burning for a specific reason, the timing of burns depends on why you're burning. If you're burning to encourage the prairie to flower and you don't have any other particular problems, you do dormant season burns, which is any time from now until March. Then once you get into April and May, you can still burn, but you would inhibit spring-growing plants and encourage the grasses a little bit more burning later.
Okay, that was the second part of my question. So now would be a good time to burn to encourage forbs versus encouraging grass to come forward. Is that correct?
Well, forbs do well with fall burns and fall planting. If you want to enrich your planting, burning it off soon and then adding seed is one way to diversify your planting. I'll probably be burning at my house tomorrow, and we might just be burning backfires to get ready for a spring burn. It depends on the wind and how much time we have. We don't have a lot of equipment. You can hire people to help you with burns. Burning is a little scary, and you have to know what you're doing to do it, and I've been doing it for almost well, I won't say, more than...
more than 10 years.
More than 10 years. And you just... I've only had one get away, and that was the first one. So I learned to be very, very careful. But you can hire people now. It's a lot of the volunteer fire departments will now do... can be hired, or some of them, sort of a private company kind of thing, can be hired to come out and do burns for people.
Well, that's a good suggestion. We had not looked into that, but we burned for several years with no problems, knock on wood. So
yes.
We were cautious. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Louise in Pewaukee, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Your show is real interesting with Molly and Mark. I have a question. My first one was on tamarack trees.
Okay.
Yes. Pardon?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I'm wondering, would it be possible to, like, dig one out and transplant it in the Pewaukee area and leave it grow? And how much light would it need?
Tamaracks...
Do they lose their needles?
Yes. Tamaracks are gold-colored right now. Aldo Leopold has a wonderful essay called Smoky Gold about the tamaracks turning color in the fall in Sand County Almanac. They are, some of them are bare, some of them are gold, and they will lose their needles.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not evergreen, but they are conifers. Nonetheless, you can transplant them, and at the Arboretum, we even have them growing in the horticultural garden along with some European larches.
Cool.
They tend naturally to grow in acid soil where it's wet. So you think of tamarack bogs.
Right.
And I doubt they would do well in very heavy soil that wasn't wet or heavy soil at all. So transplanting them is possible. Of course, being careful how you dig them, where you dig them, and getting some soil with them is important.
Mm. And with buckthorn... what's the best way to get rid of it? And where did it actually come from?
Well, there are a few species of buckthorn. I don't know if they're all from Europe or not. But they tend to be European, that particular one. You know, any plant out of place can be a pest. Our black cherries are pests in Europe, and our goldenrods are pests in Japan. So just we share and share alike. So they're European, and the way to get rid of them is to go through. These are one of those we talked earlier about. There being male and female. There are female buckthorns. If you have a lot of buckthorn, go through quickly and take out the females that would have black fruit on them right now, and then treat the stumps with Roundup, or there's another commercially available herbicide called Garlon. There's varieties of those, so talk to the place that you're purchasing them to get the correct one and treat the stumps. Or you can, with Garlon, you can pre-treat the base of the tree and kill it and then cut it down later. But nonetheless, get the females first if you have a big outbreak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I have oaks and I have hickory and cherry in the forest area of my yard.
Yeah.
And I'm just afraid that the buckthorn are kind of like taking over.
Right. Well, and they do.
And they do. So you need to get rid of them if at all possible. Louise, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Adam in Brussels. Let's turn to you now. Hi, Adam.
Hi. About 20 years ago, we transferred our Century Farm. We took 80 acres of the farmland. We transplanted all kinds of white spruce and arborvita. And we've been digging them out and selling them as landscape trees and stuff for people that want native species, and we kind of just let them grow wild, no fertilizer or pesticides, and then the 80 acres is in prairie. But in our woods for four generations, we've always maintained a good canopy and saved all the big trees. And well, I'm kind of interested in how to get involved with the large tree and champion tree survey up in the Door County and Kewaunee County areas.
I think Bruce Allison would be the person to contact with that. He's the one who's written the most recent books about it, and he can at least connect you with the people who can measure the tree correctly and keep all the data and put it on the list.
Yeah, it's our Bruce Allison, and I think if you just go online, his name is going to pop up for sure.
There is a lot of monster trees up in the.
Well, he'd be quite interested in knowing. Yeah, he'd be interested. Yeah,
an institute is probably one of the largest cottonwood trees I've ever seen. I mean, it's just growing right in the middle of the parking lot of the Institute Saloon. It's got to be about 20-some feet around.
And, and no one's run into it yet.
Yeah, I don't know. Everybody's driven past it.
Yeah.
Well, give Bruce Allison, go online, you'll find his. I don't happen to have his phone number right handy, but go online. His name's going to pop up, and shoot him an email, and you're going to, I'm sure, get a response. Thank you so much for calling. Don in Warren, Illinois, we're on to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi. Larry Mueller Show, my favorite source of information. question. I have American chestnuts.
Yes.
And they need pruning. Okay. Am I opening up a can of worms if I break through the bark, or is there a time or a condition or something I should use?
Well, the general recommendation is to not use pine tar or those kinds of things on trees unless you're worried about insects, which is one of the things you would worry about with the chestnut. But I think if you prune it this time of year, for instance, it has time to get a hardened layer of cells across that, and you would not have to worry about insects. It's the same thing as the cautions with oaks, is to not prune them between April and August. And, you know, if you want to be even safer, say April to September this year, the weather's been so strange. But you should be okay right now pruning them, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the chestnut blight? That's the one I'm afraid of, because the parent trees are in another location and they're dying.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, because of the disease is carried by insects. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So there you go.
All right. Thank you much.
Yeah. Thanks, Don. Thank you for calling. And we've got Danielle in Milwaukee. He's planning on moving back to the family farm located in Shawnee, Wisconsin. It's no longer in operation. We have many acres of lawn as well as undeveloped land. As I do not see a use in a 6-acre front yard and do not wish to mow anymore, what are my best options for either reforesting or renaturalizing my land?
Well, you have a lot of opportunities there with native landscaping, planting to prairie, and then picking places that you want to have some trees. But just remember, if you're trying to do both, to not do them too close together and be careful with which trees you use so they don't invade your prairie planting. There are a lot of resources. Both the wild ones would have information for you. The Arboretum has information on the website. And you can get books and books about planting prairies. So talk to somebody near you or talk to one of the nurseries near you. It's a lot easier to plant a prairie now than it used to be when we started all of this, because there's a lot of information out there and there are many, many good people doing work.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to Joe in Franklin. Joe, hello to you.
Hi. I live in Franklin, and we've got the emerald ash borer out here. They're going to take down an ash in my front yard and replace it with a linden.
Yes.
What can I expect with a linden?
Well, lindens are a forest tree. The maple basswood forest was the dominant ecosystem over where you are before settlement. And basswoods have smooth bark. They have large leaves that are yellow in the fall. They have a very nice blossom that's very fragrant. You've probably had basswood honey. It's very popular honey to have in the spring, so they are fragrant. It's a nice tree. I wouldn't recommend it right on the street, but in the yard it will probably do well.
Oh, well, they're going to put it by the street. How quick of a growing tree is it?
Well, it's faster than an oak, slower than a cottonwood.
Oh, okay. All right, well, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Lynn in Green Bay, on to you. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. I have a question for you about some trees to plant in my backyard. I have a pond in my backyard, and right behind that is my property line where there's a wetland preserve. Unfortunately, about 100 yards behind that wetland preserve, the city's decided to develop the land and is putting in some lovely, ugly buildings. And I'm not sure what I can put, but I'd like to plant some sort of tree that would grow relatively flat, fast, and provide some blockage for the new development going up. Do you have any suggestions on that?
So the tree's going to have wet feet?
I'm sorry?
The tree's going to have, it'll be in wet soil?
Yes, yes. I have a pond, and there's about, oh, maybe a five-foot span where there's higher land, but as the pond overflows, it flows into that wetland, so I'd like to plant some plants in that space.
And do you have a favorite kind of tree that you're thinking about, or are you just interested in trees that grow in wet areas?
And that will block a view.
Well, correct, yes. Something that will grow in a wet area and could block a view.
Well, I think if you want it, the view blocked all year round in a wet area, I would be thinking of arborvitae or white cedar.
Okay.
You could plant them in groups, interplant them with the tamarack we were talking about with a little earlier, which won't help in the winter because the needles drop off, but it will add some interest.
Okay.
Add some shrubs like the red osier dogwood that would provide some color against those two plants. I like hawthorns, and some of the hawthorns can tolerate some wet feet. So you can look into some hawthorns down there, too, to add interest for the birds.
Wonderful. That's one of the other things I was thinking of. So thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. On to Gary in Boscobel. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Larry. I just wanted to bring up, there's been a lot of talk about trees today, and I've been doing prairie conservation for 30 years or so. And I wanted to bring up the concept that maybe we're planting too many trees. I've seen many, many acres, hundreds of acres of pastures in the rural areas being planted to trees. And as a result, we're losing precious grassland bird habitat, even if it's simply cool season grasses. That habitat's disappearing fast. And one of the problems is that there's financial incentives to plant trees in all of these pastures, and there is no financial incentive to plant prairies.
You know, and I'm going to have to break in because we're just getting short of time because I wanted Molly to make a comment.
Well, I very much agree with Gary. And in fact, I've thought about forming the Anti-Arbor Day Association. We don't need to plant trees in our grasslands. In fact, at my property out near Pine Bluff, I clear trees from grasslands to try to encourage things like meadowlarks, bobolinks and dick thistles and some of the sparrows. Hearing a meadowlark in the spring is there's nothing like it, and it's really hard to do right now because we have. So if you have property out in rural areas, I think we've mostly been talking to landowners in urban situations, but rural areas really would not encourage trees even on the fence row if you can help it.
Yeah, there you go. And thank you very much for calling. And Mark and Molly, thank you both so much for being with us today. And I want to direct people back to the UW Arboretum website for that map. Just go to uwarboretum.org. That's the place where you're going to go and find the new IMAP that Mark has worked very hard on, and a lot of people have worked very hard on it. I think it's a really interesting look at the Arboretum with a lot of great information on it. And thank you very much for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.